Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, everybody. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, the 20th of January. And in just a minute, I'm going to welcome my first guest to Your Money Today of 2026. And that's my old buddy, Rick Ackerman from downstate Florida here, down about 4 hours down 95 from where I am. You know, before I bring Rick on, he and I have known one another for a good number of years. We've been on different podcasts and portals together. We've been on a few mining field trips together and see each other every now and then. Usually in the wintertime, I'm down his way and we visit and play a little bit of golf, if that's what you call what we do, which is kind of a stretch sometimes, I think. But anyway, I saw Rick a couple or 3 weeks ago when he was up my way, and I asked him if he'd come on because I want to talk about a subject that I've spent a lot of time on in the recent past, and that is the treasury market. You know, it's fashionable when you start a new year, if you're a pundit of some kind, that you're going to make predictions, sometimes dire ones. And I've seen a couple of cute little graphics that I'm sharing here, you know, that others have had in the early days of 2026. Yours truly has talked about the bond market a fair bit. And right at the beginning of the year, I warned that the chart was looking as though you're going to break above what had been a key resistance level of 4.2% on a 10-year treasury. I said if we do that, it's going to quickly prove to be kryptonite to some markets, because markets to a great extent are priced almost across the board on lower interest rates going forward and softer inflation, an accommodative Fed, and all these kind of things. Of course, the worst bond market in the world, and I sent this to our mailing list yesterday, is in Japan, where you've really had a debacle in the market, yield spiking, the yen has weakened. Interestingly enough, it hasn't hurt Japanese stocks very much, but that I think is coming. In the last couple of trading days, we did finally get the break above 4.2%. I talked about that yesterday, and I've got Rick here today to help us unpack this. We're going to talk about the fundamental situation. We're going to talk about the technicals as he sees it. Not very encouraging news that I think Rick's going to have as far as how bad this might get as far as a bond market. And then we're going to see if there's going to be any meaningful resolution to a situation where, as I've said it many, many times, the math is just against President Trump and against, I think, the U.S. generally. So, Rick, anyway, all that said, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks much for inviting me on, Chris. I've always been a fan of your newsletter, which tells it like it is. And, you know, we do go back a ways to the mining junkets we used to take with Al Corlin and his group, just seeing where all the gold and silver is buried.
Yeah. And that was always fun. And it's fun to compare notes like this. Before we get into the subject of the bond market, Rick, tell us a little bit about rickackerman.com. And I'll have a link, of course, to Rick's website with the notes to this presentation. But, you know, Rick, you've had your Rick's Picks service for quite a while, very technical, very formulaic kind of trading. So tell us what people are going to find at rickackerman.com.
Well, the site features a changing commentary every week. I put something out Sunday. It can be a rant about this or that, politics, or usually the markets, though, and the economy. There are also a list of touts. I follow widely tracked vehicles such as the E-mini S&Ps, gold, silver, GDXJ, crude oil, Bitcoin. And my forecasts there are purely technical. I try to make the advice as specific and actionable as possible. So these are generally very precise targets that I give using a technical method that is my own baby, something that's evolved over a period of perhaps 40 years. So it's based on ABCD patterns, but when you look at the same pattern for 40 years, you get pretty good at figuring it out. So inside, for paying subscribers, there is a trading room where the focus is mainly on tradable advice. We try to I encourage subscribers to post things, ideas that could be useful to other traders, meaning they post before the trades are happening and with specific stop losses and price targets and things like that. So it's and there's a corresponding room. It's called the Coffee House, and there the focus is not on actionable trades, but it's I would say a wide-ranging discussion.
I like that. You remember who Jim Rogers is? He's lived overseas for years now, but he used to be in New York. And I think that one of the things that he had years ago was Riverside Conversations, where in the early days of the internet, he had a bunch of people sitting around a fireplace, with their scotch and kibitzing on the world. And then more recently, some folks started a thing, the Boys at the Bar. And they would be on camera, talking about things over cocktails or whatever. And it's nice to have that kind of a coffee house kind of thing, or something that we're not trying to talk over everybody's head, but just give people good, useful information. And you've got your niche definitely with Rick's Picks and your service. So that's cool stuff. I've always enjoyed that.
Thanks. I do remember Jim Rogers. He was great fun. He did spend a lot of time motorcycling around the world, and it was always an interesting show.
Oh yeah, I mean, is his one of his books, Investment Biker. It's a great story about all of his travels and the investment aspects of it and stuff like that. Well, let's dive into the treasury market. $39 trillion, to round it upwards a little bit. We'll get there officially any day now, of course, the rate things are going, and on ever onward and upward. What we're seeing happen today is you and I are talking, and I looked at the screen just before we started recording, and we're doing this at, of course, 2 o'clock Eastern time. We don't know how things are going to close, but the last I looked, the market, as far as the stock market, was at its low of the day, or roughly 800 points lower, and yet Treasury yields are near their highs of the day. That usually doesn't happen. If you've got a risk-off attitude in the markets, the stock market's going down. Traditionally, the position that investors take is they buy treasuries, but now they're selling them along with everything. So we can argue about which is the dog and which is the tail, but the whole dynamic with treasuries being sold off is more than just a stock market. I mean, we've got a lot of things coming to a head, don't we?
Yeah, for sure. And I did send you some longer term charts of the bonds. When you get sort of focused on the day to day, you could get the idea that any significant anything that occurs on a day that seems significant is more than it really is. So we're T-bond futures right now around 114.11. 30 seconds. That corresponds with an interest rate of 4.91%. So I could see a rally right here, all the way up to from 114 on a bond futures up to around maybe 121, 122. And you can bet that if that happened, everybody would think, oh, hey, it's finally, come alive. But on a big chart, you're looking at a top that occurred with the COVID low in interest rates up around 192. So this little 7 or 8 point rally that I could see right now, and that's not even necessarily to say that it will happen. I would say more likely is the bond futures will keep coming down, which would of course correspond to higher rates.
Well, we're going to get to the technical picture even more in a minute, because I want to talk about that breakout level that the 10-year Treasury had, the one you just referred to, that's 4.91 and change. That's the 30-year long-term bond, and a lot of people are waiting with bated breath to see if we get a five handle back on that. I think that's going to scare some people who still don't really take this move up in yields seriously. But we gotta first talk about how we got here. I mean, we've got, again, you rounded upward to $39 trillion national debt, And I think one of the major problems and disappointments for those who voted for the whole MAGA agenda and cheered when President Trump brought Elon Musk in to identify all of these zillions of dollars of waste and everything is that the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill has zero or nearly zero interest in doing a damn thing about reining in the size of government, reining in government spending. We're still spending money at the same emergency level as during the Biden administration, by and large. And even last year, the president's one big, beautiful baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, MAGA, the flag bill, and all the other stuff he called it, that is a base case, increases the debt 20 trillion more over a decade. So they gave us $2 trillion average annual deficits for 10 more years. And we think that yields are going to come down in that environment. He thinks the yields can come down in that environment. Not hardly, huh?
Now, it's and the irony of Trump is that bonds would really be falling apart if there were not this perception that Trump is the only leader in the world that's really in charge of the nation he commands. So that has actually attracted a flow of foreign money into U.S. paper. But even there, not just patience, but investor optimism about U.S. having its financial affairs in order is confidence is, let's say, at a critical threshold. It's not going to endure forever, especially if Trump is talking about boosting the defense budget by a half a trillion dollars. And
That's crackpot end of empire stuff, really.
it really is. And he's taken on so much. You could make a case that he's doing it all for the better good, and that one, I'm sure he's read The Art of War, and you can't have a war unless you flush the enemy out. If they're going to sort of stay behind the ramparts, you don't get to fight any battles. But Trump has been so provocative here, not just of Europe, but of the state of Oregon and California, that he's just looking for a war. And I think that if you could ascribe a higher purpose to that, something that might actually work, it would be whatever China's observations would be, or U.S. enemies, China, let's say even North Korea. They're watching all this and they're thinking this guy's an absolute madman, and he really does what he says he's going to do. So you could make that argument that the wars that Trump is picking domestically are intended for a global audience.
Well, I think they are to some extent. And look, I even said back when before he got sworn in the second time over a year ago, or just, well, actually a year ago today is when he got sworn in again. But I said even before that, that a lot of his agenda and his seeming intent, which he's proven over the last 12 months, to do a lot of things and push a lot of things harder than he did in what was the blah first term. It's all well and good. I mean, the Donroe Doctrine, I'm 110% on board with that whole thing philosophically. And he's far from the first president, for example, that said we needed to have control over Greenland. I mean, that started right after the Civil War, let alone in a very big way when Harry Truman actually tried to pay $100 million in gold to buy Greenland. So that's no secret that we've had that and other strategic aims in our own hemisphere. But the albatross around his neck back when he started, and even more so now, is that he's trying to prosecute all these different geopolitical aims and political aims, which I agree with more than not, for the most part. But he's starting from such a deficit with this national debt. And will the markets let him do this? I mean, my cartoonist Jerry King always comes up with great winners for me. Here's another one that I had him do recently, kind of a takeoff on the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the good here, the good guy that's probably going to win this fight, are the bond market vigilantes. And was it Henry Kaufman that coined that term, Rick, back in the 70s,
Yes, it was.
originally? And simply put, when you're asking markets with their money to finance debt, they're looking at credit risk, they're looking at inflation risk, they're looking at sovereign risk, all these different kind of things. And the situation has not improved. with President Trump. And that's why, for all of his whining to the contrary that the Fed should be pushing rates even lower and all the rest of this stuff, if he wants to know why the market's still got interest rates high and they're going to go higher, look in the mirror, Mr. President.
Yeah, and I would agree. I'm completely on board with the Don Rowe doctrine. It's you look at it and you think there was actually a day when we were fearful of the Sandinistas and even things that were happening in Cuba and Cuban soldiers in Angola, and we were worried about what the Chinese were doing in Venezuela, and to assert dominance in our own hemisphere, I think is something that even. Well, you can see the Democrats are not much arguing with it. Since Trump captured Maduro, the talk has sort of quieted down, and everybody
Sure has.
realizes, well, what's wrong with that? Why do we need the Chinese snooping around Venezuela, presenting some constant threat when we can just say, hey, you better get the hell out of there, because this is not your backyard, nor will it ever be. So I think you have to agree with those things. But on the fiscal front, there's only so much he can do. He talks about affordability, and although he has, I guess, helped to force prices down, certainly for fuel at the pump and a couple of other things, some drugs that Americans like to take to lose weight. The bigger picture is structural, and I hate to say it, but I think he's a dead duck there, especially with the expansionist goals that he has right now.
Well, had he been serious and had he backed the proper people on Capitol Hill, and this has been a political burr in my saddle for a long time. I mean, it was stupid for him early on to support House Speaker Johnson. He could have supported Rick Scott for the Senate leader and here in our state, who believes in the MAGA agenda, certainly more than John Thune from South Dakota does. These guys, along with, I believe, the Attorney General and some others, are slow walking his agenda to the midterms to make sure that not a hell of a lot gets done. I hate to say that's the appearance that you get. But he didn't do himself any favors by backing these people, by his one big beautiful monstrosity that kept Biden era spending limits, even when you look at the outside the continuing resolution framework. So at some point you've got to pay up if you want credit in the world, and it doesn't mean that the US is going to default. It doesn't mean that we're going to go kaput tomorrow. It doesn't mean that the president's wrong on a lot of things he wants to do. It means that when you've got such ridiculous, gargantuan funding needs, you don't, sorry, Mr. President, you're going to pay up for those, not pay lower yields.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the way he's gone after Powell, it's like Powell's going to be sorry he was ever born, and but you also wonder who he has in mind. I mean, I think Powell is probably as complicit as he could be within the bounds of sanity, and if Trump, well, I'm not even sure Trump wants his way entirely. It's if he had no resistance at all on the Fed board, who knows where we'd be? Maybe interest rates would already be down there around 1%. But I think even the man in the street senses that we really don't need 1% interest rates, that there's something wrong about that, and because we're so with the federal deficit pushing 40 trillion dollars.
Well,
I
and that's the
know.
issue, Rick, because the economy arguably doesn't need it, but the Treasury does, and that's the kind of. I was using with a few other people last spring when the whole thing in Japan started to unravel the term, and I didn't originate it, but others have used it, the end of global financial repression. In the wake of the 2008 crash, in order to reliquify markets, make sure that we didn't go into a deflationary spin around a toilet bowl and get completely flushed, the central banks all pushed interest rates down to nothing. Sometimes less than nothing. We had quantitative easing introduced to the world where central banks, more than they ever did, became buyers of last resort of treasuries. And they kept that regimen for so long that you've had all these distortions. creep up in the market. So now we're at a place with, as you said, rounded upward even just a little bit more, we'll be there before the end of the calendar year, 40 trillion or 40 trillion plus in debt. That costs money. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we crossed a $1 trillion annualized interest cost for that national debt. We're going to be at least $1.5 trillion annualized before this year is over. And you and I
Yeah.
were comparing notes earlier. What is it, eight plus trillion this year is rolled over?
That's the number, and of course, someone's got to buy it all,
Yeah.
and the Treasury is going to have to finance it at the going rate.
Yeah. And Treasury Secretary Bessent has already made clear, and realizing how much against him things are, that they know they can't lock in long-term yields. Arguably, you look at Bernanke or Janet Yellen, they should have used the generational lows and long-term bonds to lock up a lot of the debt longer term. They didn't really do it that much. So now you got all this stuff coming due. And now it's Uncle Sam who's the biggest payday borrower out there because all this stuff is going to be all done short term. But even if you look at, Treasury bills, 3.5%, give or take, that's a lot more interest payment than even what the stuff was financed at previously that's now coming due. So you got this interesting mess that, as far as the economy, like you said, and I agree, the economy hardly needs lower yields. In fact, there's a lot of people pushing back, including the bond market vigilantes, that are going to punish the Fed and drive long-term rates even higher if the Fed does get coerced into reducing interest rates. So that's a problem.
Yeah, you make a more fundamental point too in your latest newsletter that I think Trump would agree wholeheartedly with, and that is, why should taxpayers be paying all that interest to
True.
the Federal Reserve? It's like it makes people think, well, where does that money come from, and who's really paying it, and how do we pay it? But I don't think anybody can understand why the Fed has to rake in all that interest, when it should be essentially available to the banking system.
Well, and that's a whole different discussion for another day, is that the very nature of our banking system needs to be changed. I loved what Justin Amash said, the former congressman from Michigan, when the news came out about the criminal investigation against Powell. He said, "My problem," this is a congressman talking, "my problem is that the Federal Reserve exists." He's one like Ron Paul and you and me that would come up with a much better way of doing things where the public isn't paying interest for their own money. And he went on to say President Trump's problem is that the Fed doesn't exist just to serve him, because it is untenable in our present system for the Fed to do what the president demands without completely destroying the dollar and really having the bond market blow out. So it's, the Fed at various points in its history, as this whole fractional reserve system gets more and more and more stretched, we're past the point, long past the point, where our debts would ever be payable, repayable, I should say. Now they're hardly serviceable without causing problems.
Right. And you just said before the dollar gets totally destroyed, but
Yeah.
if you go back to 1913, it's come a long way, the wrong
Sure
way.
has. It sure has. But so fundamentally, I think you and I can agree that for the foreseeable future, the risks are that yields are going to continue to move up. Inflation is still sticky. Federal spending is continuing to blow out and blow out the debt with it. Another element of this, depending on how everything shakes out, we're going to learn a lot about how what much President Trump is bluffing or not, along with everybody else at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week, which is now getting underway. But Ray Dalio of Bridgewater this morning made an interesting comment. He said, you add to all of this mix that we're already talking about, intensified capital wars now. And will the rest of the world, in a much bigger way than what's been threatened, retaliate against the U.S.? Because you commented earlier that a lot of the world, and properly so, has, favored disproportionately U.S. dollar-based assets. Because for all of our problems, we're still the cleanest shirt in a dirty laundry pile when it comes to the world. But will that sustain itself if the president's really going to go to the mat over a lot of different things and the rest of the world says, fine, we're going to pull back on those promised investments in the US. We're going to sell the US tech stocks and buy other stuff. We're going to sell what we have left of treasuries, et cetera. How much of a risk do you think that is, Rick?
Well, we're still the best game in town. And if
Yeah.
you talk about selling U.S. tech stocks, there's only so many Swedish,
Yeah, what do
as
you
there
buy?
was, what do you buy exactly? So Trump has really done a lot. I don't even know who in the European constellation would oppose him at this point. We've sort of swung the axis away from LIBOR rates. And I guess Trump, even while implicitly destroying the dollar, has made it stronger. And I think he's sort of seized the initiative there, and the whole Euro complex is really back on its heels. They don't much control anything right now,
No.
and it's all according to what Trump wants to do and what he says.
Well, that's one of the paradoxes here is that, for as much as the president on his sleeve has warned that he wants a weaker dollar, it's going to help our trade position. Yes, we'll have a little bit more inflation, but it'll drive up asset prices across the board and make, in relative terms, make the federal debt a little bit less bad. That's always been the playbook. The Democrats are the tax and spend party. Republicans are the borrow and spend party, and they always are promising that we're going to have the economy so wonderful that it's going to broaden the tax base and make the debt manageable even as we continue to raise it. And, sometimes that's been true, but more often than not, it hasn't been. But let's talk about the dollar for a minute because I want to put your dollar chart back up on the screen that you shared with me. It wasn't that long ago that it looked as though the dollar was completing kind of a basing pattern and might turn higher. And one of the interesting things that could happen is that we all remember 2008 when the wheels were coming off the global economy and markets, so markets first, of course. And in that event, the dollar doesn't go down. The dollar's tendency is to scream higher. Because everybody is scrambling for dollars, the currency, the global reserve currency, such as it is, with a few more warts these days, that's still its role, and the dollar could surge higher in value if you had a bad situation. Do you see any pressures like that growing, or are we kind of in a no man's land right now, hostage to events?
Well, the dollar is got a couple of things going for it, really. Number one, it's the only currency that's big enough to handle all the shell game action that takes place in this world. We depending on whose numbers you use, you could value the market in derivative instruments. It's somewhere between a quadrillion and a half, and perhaps $2.5 quadrillion. So against that, if you weigh global GDP, that's more like about $200 trillion. The question arises, why do you need $2 quadrillion worth of action, a $2 quadrillion edifice, to support actual trade in goods and services? That's maybe 10% of that. And even if you use the very low end estimates on the derivatives market, it's still orders of magnitude larger than what we actually trade in goods and services. So you come to the logic of saying that the business of this world is no longer getting your hands dirty making things. It's really just kind of shuffling paper. So there's no currency or no medium really that could absorb all the action there. And even transitioning from a world that's used to having monopoly money as much as it needs for this big game, you can't get from here to there. You really can't.
Yeah.
So anybody who's talked about another reserve currency or a basket of currencies to support the oil markets, well, as big as the oil markets are, and even as big as the markets in treasury debt are, they're dwarfed by the total sum, notional sum of derivative instruments. So there, the dollar has it handles all the action, and that's why it's going to stay. All right. And the other thing is, Of course, if you talk about the dollar going up or down, it's relative to everything else. And although the dollar may not do too well relative to gold, it hasn't been doing so well. And I think that's going to continue for the foreseeable future against pretty much everything else. It's not even a race, you know. It's so the dollar index is somewhere around 98 and a half. And it's one of the few things, one of the few tradable things where there's nothing particularly distinctive about what happened with the beginning of the COVID era. You know, we had a low in interest rates then. We had in the bullion markets, the low in COVID is kind of a reference point, but for the dollar, it's just a point somewhere up a little bit around 100. So I think the dollar could just kind of tread water, go sideways more or less forever. Because it just has to be weighed against other assets and
Well, great point.
other currencies.
Yeah, great point. And I've said many times myself too, for all the hysteria over there's going to be a gold-backed BRICS currency and this and that. I mean, the only logical anchor for a BRICS currency is China, and they have hardly have a transparent banking system for the most part in the last several years. Anybody with half a brain is trying to get money out of China, not into it. So there aren't very many alternatives. And the euro, which was supposed to be the new global reserve currency there a quarter of a century or so ago when it came out, they now are half of the daily global exchange reserves are in euros of what the peak was of about 22, 24% when it started. Of course, they've done that to themselves. I mean, that's a continent and a block that, whether it's economically, culturally, or whatever, has been committing slow motion suicide for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there was a time when Britain was leaving the European, the euro. Whether the whole euro experiment, the currency experiment, was going to go down the tubes, but they just sort of they hung in there, but only for at this point, only for political reasons, really. And they're losing their edge there. They really can't support the euro as a strong currency that has a role to play in global finance. They're really just an also-ran at this point.
Pretty much. Well, let's wind down, Rick. I want to talk about another chart that you shared with me earlier. I'm going to have it up here while we're talking for a minute, and that is your target yield for the 10-year Treasury in particular.
Yeah, it's I there were a couple notes, technical notes on that chart, but just to kind of summarize it, we've had Treasury yields go from a COVID low of somewhere down around 0.4%, if you can believe that, to a high back in late 2023, up around 5.15%. So since then, it's come down to lows around, let's say, 3.94 or so, currently trading 4.91%. But I think we're headed up to at least 5.34%.
And that's the 30-year. I misspoke and said 10. You're talking to
Oh,
30.
absolutely. No, actually, this is a 10-year.
Oh, you're talking 10-year. All right, I thought you were, just to be sure.
So 10-year currently around, well, exactly 4.915%. But I think it's going higher, 25% higher, which is what the 5.34% rate would amount to. And the reason I'm pretty sure of that is just the chart itself, off that 5.15% high that we hit in 2023, it began a correction. And by my runes, the correction came down to exactly, let's see, it's 3.84%. I'm having to look around my Logitech camera at my
That's all right.
chart. But all right, so it came down to 3.84, and that represents, with my technical analysis system, good strong trends generate relatively weak counter trends. So in this case, the corrective trend in rates The counter trend came down exactly to the midpoint. It could have fallen as low as 2.53% if we were going to see yields come down. Instead, it rallied exactly off that red line, what I call the midpoint pivot, and hit a high back in the first or second quarter of 2025 of 5.15. But we're on our way to surpassing that, and I'm not even going to make a prediction as to what that holds for Trump's popularity and his credibility if all this $8 trillion in refis that the Treasury is going to have to do is being done at those kind of rates.
Well, I agree with you, and I said that that's why I said when he first got sworn in again that my theme last year was let's do the math. And looking at even a worse situation now in 2026 with a couple or 3 trillion more in debt added, et cetera, he's not in a good place unless he's willing, which he's not. If he were willing to come out and say, look, we're going to get rid of the Fed, or we're going to phase it out because it's doesn't serve its purpose anymore, doesn't serve the American people. We're going to come up with a national currency, a currency board with the best expert we've got, et cetera. There's things he can do as far as a monetary system that would change the game, but I hardly see him doing that. He certainly would not have a lot of support on Capitol Hill for that. He's going to be in trouble with this fight that he's picked with the Fed. Even getting a new chairman confirmed at this point. There's a couple of senators that are going to be the swing votes that have said, until this prosecution of Powell goes away, forget about getting anybody. So in this sense, the president screwed up in reverse. He's going to have Powell as chairman beyond May at the rate things are going right now. And he's not going to get any more rate cuts because now the Fed, even if they didn't have reason to sit on their hands, which they already do, now they're going to do it longer, all else being equal, just to show that they're still, quote, independent, which is, that's a sacrosanct thing on Capitol Hill that they've got all the senators and congressmen believing in. You can't question the Fed.
Yeah, I think with your latest letter, that's probably the most assertive prediction you've made that, here's Powell practically under indictment. Trump would like to put him in jail. And yet you're saying that Trump, who has all his power and influence and authority right now, is going to be Trump has all this influence now. He seems to be unstoppable. Well, the thing he wants to do most, get rid of Jerome Powell, is it's not going to happen. That Powell's going to still be with us, and that will be part of Trump's credibility problem a little bit down the road. But at least then the source of it will be very recognizable.
I mean, the one thing that would do that would help the markets, I think, all else being equal, is the markets, of course, you look at two things. I mean, and let me talk about precious metals for just a second, Rick, because I know you follow this too. Gold screamed higher nonstop the last 3, 4 months last year. Just no hesitation. Silver finally caught on. Couple of different times, both of them acted like they were going to correct a little bit more seriously, but the correction stopped for two reasons. One was that prosecution of the Fed, where all of a sudden the veracity of U.S. monetary policy was going to be called into question. And the other one, of course, being the whole thing over Venezuela and Greenland and more, of a safe haven trade for the precious metals. So I think all else being equal, if it looks like Trump is not going to get his way, or if he backs down, or somehow, finds a way on a QT to pull the plug, behind the scenes and let it be known that there's no more, I'm going to shut my mouth about the Fed. I'm going to put in somebody the market likes. It's not just a Trump yes man. Maybe they buy a little bit more time, but otherwise, again, as I said earlier, the Fed is in a bad place. So how do you see what kind of events would cause the Treasury market to do the opposite of what it's been doing recently? Because one of the things I find it's interesting is that there's a record short position in TLT right now, which is the main ETF that institutions and big investors buy when they want to replicate, the long end of the bond market. And you short TLT when you believe interest rates are going to go higher in the market. That means you make money on that contrary trade. What's going to chase them all out of that?
Well, I hate to even think of it, really,
Me
because
too, because it's going to be another 2008.
Yeah, I mean, an absolute disaster that throws the world into depression. We would definitely have a flight into the treasuries would, I think, look like a safe haven then, although secondary to the safe haven in bullion.
Probably.
But TLT currently trading 86 and change. Looks to me like it's absolutely going to come down to at least 78. So that corresponds to the higher rates that I'm seeing. I would have thought, even with the peak last year at 5.1% on a 10-year, that the economy could never slog past that. But what we have now is Trump, in theory, it's not a bad idea to say we're going to grow our way out of this debt, but
Right.
the debt is so enormous that we can't do that. And there's a mismatch really in time as to how those things happen. We're going to need such enormous growth to even talk about reducing the debt load. And yet you take some of the elements of growth policy, one of which would be the reshoring of American manufacturing. Not only is there a long lead time for getting that rolling, but there's some question really as to the viability of a new manufacturing base for the US. It's not only possible, it's necessary if we've got to compete with the world, but it's going to be employee-less. There aren't going to be workers in those factories if they're going to compete. So everywhere where Trump has an idea about how we're going to make America great, I think it runs a square up against a financial reality.
It does.
So we're really just too deep in hock. And of course, for not just years, for decades, I've been writing about how the end game had to be deflationary. We're going to have to discharge this debt. You mentioned earlier something I guess most of us realize that it's beyond repayment at this point. So you go to C.V. Myers, the energy and finance forecaster, put it very simply. He said, in the end, every penny of every debt will be paid, if not by the borrower, then by the lender. And what that means is, like at the level of residential mortgages, that people just leave the keys in the mailbox. It's not like somebody hasn't paid, the bondholders pay. So even in a bigger picture, we're paying for the debt we've amassed right now by a precipitous decline in the standard of living. And that is notwithstanding all the technological wizardry that makes our lives so, I'm going to say interesting, but we've got our cell phones and all kinds of cool
Sure.
gizmos. But the things that really count that we had in the 1950s, affordable health care, affordable college education, wives could stay home and raise their children. Those are big things in the standard of living that's already been sacrificed. So we paid the price really. That's the price of inflation, but we still have all that debt. It will have to be discharged. And I'm not going to get into it here because I've been writing about it for 30 years, but to me, there's only one way to get rid of it, and that will be through a deflation, a debt deflation.
Right. And I tend to agree with that. We're going to have to revisit that subject one of these days soon and explain the form that that might take and the consequences of that. So anyway, great stuff, Rick. Great insights as always. Folks, go to rickackerman.com, learn more about Rick, learn about his subscription service, look at all the goodies he's got there. Smart guy. Again, I've known him for a long, long, long time, and very good insights. So Rick, any parting thoughts as far as what you're expecting near term? Anything stand out?
Well, just thanks for the kind words for
Yeah.
and as far as I put out a commentary this weekend that I'm no longer going to talk about a topping process. I've been saying that the market's had it and it's in a topping process, but reality, nobody can pick the top, and we're already at such an irrational extreme that it's pointless to say that more irrationality and more extremity is going to produce an actual top. So for all I know, the Dow could it could double or triple in the next 5 to 10
Knows?
years. Who knows exactly? So I would
Well,
say keep your not even keep your powder dry, just make sure that you have something and something that's safe, meaning everybody hates it and the yields are low, and of course We're talking about some power company in Nevada
Sure.
nice dividend paying company. So, but yeah, I'm done calling tops.
Well, look, I think Ray Dalio, I mentioned him earlier real quick since you brought that up,
You
Rick.
talk about smart guys.
Well, he is, and he said sort of what you did, and I've said the same thing recently as well, that you can see bubbles. I mean, there's no question that by every sensible historical financial measure, the stock market is over skis as much as it was in 1929, as much as it was in 1999, as much as it was in 2007, etc. But there has still been such a tailwind that that doesn't mean it has to come down just because it's a bubble. The question is, what is the event? What is something that causes people to actually sell that breaks the bubble? Will it be that bigger loss of confidence in the U.S. as the best place in the world and a safe haven if the whole world thinks that, Trump really is off his nut and, we just have to extricate ourselves from dependence on the U.S. faster? Is it something like that? Is it the bond market spike? Because I believe and have for a while that if the yields continue to go up as much as you expect and I expect as well, and the government can't figure out a way to mash them back down, that itself is going to knock the legs out from under the market. That's what caused the 87 crash when you had for a while this big uncontrollable spike in market interest rates that finally pulled the rug out from under stocks back then. So who knows? But the old saying is the market can stay irrational longer than the short seller can stay solvent. After all, it was the end of 1996 that former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan made his famous irrational exuberance speech, and the market went up for 3 more years. So,
With his help, by
with
the
his help, yeah, he was the mad monetary scientist of all time. Never met an unregulated derivative he didn't like. And he was that was we can talk about him all day long too. But anyway, look, I'll let you go for now, Rick. I appreciate the insights. I know the listeners do, and we're definitely going to have you back again.
Oh, thanks. I'd
We're glad
certainly
you joined
enjoy
us
the
today.
opportunity.
As always,
Thanks for
write to
staying.
Chris
All
at
right, take care. I look forward to seeing you soon,
nationalinvestor.com
too.
with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.